please think insulin. For heart attacks, please think insulin. For your memory preservation, please think insulin. If you want to say no to dialysis, please think insulin. If you want to say no to diabetes, diabetes-related retinopathy, neuropathy, just learn to think insulin. Try to read a couple of my articles in the free insulin course. Try to have a spicy beginning. Try to have it on some days of the week, and you will find sooner or later that it's just as easy to do all the days of the week. And then it's very time efficient. I said it's low cost. I don't know how you can have a lower cost, healthier breakfast than this. And I do believe that a spicy, excellent, health-promoting, oxystatic breakfast is the single best day thing you can do for your metabolic health. For your spiritual health, well, I have some suggestions, and there is a free course on spiritual healing, again, at www.draliwan.org. One is the number. This has been Science, Health, and Healing. I'm your host, Majid Ali. Until we meet again next Wednesday, may you be gracious, graceful, and generous in your spirit. Good night.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, WBAI in New York City, 99.5 on the FM dial, streaming live at WBAI.org. Coming up in 90 minutes at 1:30, you'll be listening to Jim Freund with Hour of the Wolf. In the meantime, we present another Earthwatch retrospective with Robert Knight. Stay tuned.
Tonight's Earthwatch starts with the Undercurrents 1989-1990 Best of Demo Tape, in which Robert Knight reports on and from Panama, including an interview with Manuel Noriega and a tense experience with the U.S. military at the Panama Canal. Segment 2 is an excerpt from a classic Earthwatch program from June of 1994, in which Robert comments on tensions regarding nuclear proliferation and militarization and how this prevents the reunification of North and South Korea. The listener phone calls provide an engaging discourse on space, Earth, politics, human consciousness, and the media, with reference to films and books. The program also includes poetry and music.
This is a demonstration tape for the Undercurrents National Program. It contains the award-winning reports by Robert Knight on Panama and special features by Laura Flanders on the death squads in South Africa, as well as other pieces. This is the Undercurrents National Program demonstration tape.
Mm-hmm. Panamanians are celebrating the 168th anniversary of their country's national independence from Spain. But as Robert Knights reports from Panama City, the festivities are overshadowed by the increasingly tense issue of military independence from the United States.
National celebrations of Panama's 1821 independence from Spain were accompanied today by a palpable sense of tension in the expectation of an imminent coup attempt and increasing confrontations between nationalistic protesters and American troops of the Southern Command, which comprises a dozen military installations throughout the country. Fears of a renewed attempt on the life or tenure of Panama Defense Forces Commander General Manuel Noriega were renewed 11 days ago with the Los Angeles Times disclosure that President George Bush had signed a secret directive authorizing a multi-million dollar coup attempt against Noriega. Bush's finding would allow the Central Intelligence Agency to encourage a coup, even at the risk of the life of a foreign leader. That decision drew a letter of protest to Bush from House Intelligence Committee Chair Anthony Bilenson and Representatives Matthew McHugh and Robert Kastenmeier. The three reportedly objected to U.S. intelligence actions leading directly or indirectly to the probable death of a head of government. In Panama, existence of the Bush administration's plan was reported to the public last week, and the National Assembly has stated that if General Noriega were to be attacked, President Bush would be held responsible, and that they could not guarantee the security and safety of United States citizens and property. Yesterday, opposition leaders whose activities have been curtailed by emergency legislation said they would consider General Noriega responsible for any attacks on them. Meanwhile, Radio Bogota reports that government-backed dignity battalions have claimed that they would retaliate against members of the opposition they believe are cooperating with U.S. intelligence interests in the event of an attempt on the life of Noriega, who is scheduled to address an international delegation in Panama City on Wednesday. Although Defense Forces Commander Noriega is not technically a head of state, he did become the government's national coordinator last Friday by a decree of the National Assembly, while the Panama City Council has proposed that he be named head of government. Noriega has asked for greater emergency powers for the Assembly, which, as coordinator, he may now convene on, quote, matters of urgent national interest, end quote. Among such matters are the dozens of confrontations in recent days between U.S. troops on maneuvers and Panamanians, who claim the routine movements of tanks, armored personnel carriers, artillery, and heavily armed troops through Panamanian territory are in violation of the Panama Canal treaties, which are due to increase Panamanian responsibilities next year in anticipation of a full turnover in 1999. Last Wednesday, for example, hundreds of civilians stood in front of United States tanks on a Panamanian street adjoining the U.S.-administered Gorgas Hospital. The protesters, along with Panamanian medical workers, accused the U.S. of using the hospital to treat Salvadoran soldiers wounded in the past 2 weeks of combat in the capital of San Salvador. The United States denies that, but Panamanian intelligence sources insist that it has been used to assist the war in El Salvador, along with what residents report as an unusually high number of military flights out of SOUTHCOM bases. Meanwhile, tension remains high with United States troops curfewed on alert status Charlie, one step short of the Delta alert invoked during the October 3rd coup attempt, and two steps below the new maximum alert level of easy. Panama has meanwhile canceled weekend leave for its soldiers as the two governments seem headed for a collision course. For example, on two separate occasions, employees of the United States government, when asked about the probable timing of an imminent United States-backed action against Noriega, replied with almost exactly the same words. When you hear the shooting start, stay indoors. One claimed to be an American military officer bringing in what he called sensitive electronics equipment to Panama on a civilian flight. The other stated that a reporter in Panama would, quote, get his money's worth, end quote, over the next few days. Both declined to elaborate further. I'm Robert Knight in Panama City.
Welcome to Undercurrents. I'm Jessica Gigi. Special report on Panama, an Undercurrents investigation. On Friday, December 22, 1989, at the height of the manhunt for Panama's General Manuel Antonio Noriega, Undercurrents senior producer Robert Knight contacted sources close to the resistance forces and obtained exclusively a recorded communique from Noriega.
In this report filed by Robert Knight, we hear Noriega's last public word and reaction to it in the United States.
To the international community, we want to say that the Bush administration is responsible for this Hiroshima, proportionate to the numbers of our people, with many civilian deaths and casualties, and information being withheld by news media controlled by the United States government. It has been an unnecessary massacre. The government of the United States did use all of the elements of provocation to justify this action, to impose a government which does not control the situation and its citizens. They have divided the Panamanian family. The one and only responsible for this is President Bush, who keeps lying to his citizens on the amount of United States military casualties. As a response of the Panamanian people and the Panama Defense Forces, it is necessary that all the international community, and the United States especially, look at this as a violation of all international treaties and the concept of international rights. The international community has been terrorized because of all of this done in the name of human rights. Tomorrow, they will violate all of the treaties signed by the United States. We call attention to this. I am Commander Noriega.
In an exclusive to WBAI, Panamanian General Manuel Noriega today gave his response to yesterday's decision by the Organization of American States, which urged the general to relinquish power. After much prodding by the United States, the 32-member body voted to send three foreign ministers to Panama in an attempt to persuade Noriega to step down. The vote was 20-2, with seven abstentions. Robert Knight is the senior producer with Undercurrents, a daily investigative news program on WBAI. Earlier today, Knight spoke by telephone with Noriega. The general would take no questions. But here is Noriega's statement in its entirety.
Yo, el ciudadano panameño, General Manuel Antonio Noriega.
I, a Panamanian citizen, Manuel Antonio Noriega, send to the people of the United States a denunciation of the North American Embassy here in Panama, which gives disinformation to its president. And for this reason, it is an aggression in which young soldiers from Texas, from Florida, are coming here. To fight against whom? Here there are no enemies. Why do they come here, armed against a defenseless people? My name has brought 3,000 men with war tanks. Why? This country is not an enemy of the United States. It has a greater force here than it had in Japan during World War II. Why? Why Panama? We are not the enemy of the United States. Why this aggression? Panama asks for respect. It asks for freedom, for its sovereignty. The time of empires has ended. Why does the United States want an empire in Panama? Why? This is our only answer, because we are black. Well, here there is no racial discrimination. The United States brings to us a psychological aggression, military, social, economic. They have stolen from us the money we put in the regular banks and on the exchange. They have a president who doesn't live here in Panama. He lives in Miami, playing the horses. Unbelievable. What's happening? It's inconceivable, impossible. The president of the United States is totally disinformed. It is a shame that a president does not get the necessary information from his own embassy. Here in Panama, everyone is unhappy about this, and he has been in office 100 days. The United States must change its attitude here in Panama. This is my message to your small radio station. The Organization of American States was owed by the United States $50 million, and it was paid in exchange for votes in order to realize a condemnation of Panama, while the United States has no use for the OAS. Today, James Baker went for the first time to the OAS. He doesn't know it. This means that Panama is worth a lot. They're making Manuel Noriega a world hero. A world hero. To the extent they attack Manuel Noriega, they make Manuel Noriega greater. In my country, there is tranquility. To the extent the United States continues to attack Manuel Noriega becomes all the greater. Thus I end my conversation with you. But I wish success and good luck to all the American people whom I love. Here there has never been a kidnapping of a North American. This is not Beirut. Here there has never been an attempt, no death of an American by violence. Here many Panamanians are married to North American soldiers, to the poorest people. Here there is a respectable Christian community. But here there are devils who believe Reagan. Here there is peace and love.
Panamanian General Manuel Antonio Noriega, who today delivered an exclusive statement to WBAI producer Robert Knight.
The United States ought to be prepared immediately with major economic assistance and major adjustment to the debt situation in Panama. The sanctions which were put in place clearly have had an effect.
What the Americans did, they had maneuvered in the area of the canal, ex-canal zone area, so that they block away the WESAD, which is our special SWAT forces. They blocked the naval command, and they blocked the Panama police in the canal zone area. So when the coup actually took stage, started early this morning, those three bases could not get from there into the headquarters to help support Noriega.
The sounds of Senator John Kerry and Mario Rognoni speaking with us from Panama on the details of the attempted coup. I'm Robert Knight in New York with Dennis Bernstein. This is Undercurrents.
Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Dennis.
You'll remember back several months ago, George Bush made the following statement regarding the Panamanians and the leadership under Noriega. The will of the people should not be thwarted by this man and a handful of these Doberman thugs, says Bush. And he calls on Panamanians to do everything they can to get Mr. Noriega out of there. I think perhaps he wasn't talking to Panamanians, Robert. I think he was talking about what the United States government had in mind for Panama.
In fact, Dennis, we have indications that the United States involvement may well be very much deeper than has thus far been admitted. We have spoken with sources inside Panama who have detailed, further than we have been able to ascertain from any other medium, the extent of United States activities during the attempted coup that was put down yesterday by the Panamanian Defense Force leadership. What we have learned from speaking with Mario Rognoni, who is the former Minister of Commerce and Industry in Panama, and someone who is very much connected with what is happening in the Panamanian government in terms of information, we have indications that the United States Southern Command military forces were conducting maneuvers that began at 4 a.m. on Tuesday morning, just prior to the outbreak of the firefight and the attempted arrest and or kidnapping of Noriega. We have new information charging. There were many more overflights than the one or two helicopters that have been referred to before. And we simply will hear the information that Mr. Rognoni presents us with, and we'll be back with the positions of the State Department and of the Southern Command itself.
The American Armed Forces have been doing or having maneuvers in the daytime, in the early nighttime, and even at dawn. So when early this morning they had maneuvered, and nobody paid attention to it. See, it was, we were beginning to get used to the fact that every other day they would have maneuvers. Now, what they did was, at starting at 4 in the morning, they blocked away. You've been in Panama. You know that we have very few military posts near within the city. You have the main headquarters, which was where the coup was to be staged. You have Panama Viejo, which was part of the coup, and then you have the bases within the canal zone area. What the Americans did, they had maneuvers in the area of the canal, ex-canal zone area, so that they block away the WESAD, which is our special SWAT forces. They blocked the naval command, and they blocked the Panama police in the canal zone area. So when the coup actually took stage, started early this morning, those three bases could not get from there into the headquarters to help support Noriega.
When you say that they blocked the way, are you talking about ground transportation, what street, what kind of equipment? How did the way get blocked?
Oh, they used a car that they call the Homer, or Homer, something like that, which is it's like a modified Jeep with a 17-millimeter machine gun on top. And then they have the small arm tanks, which are armored cars, small, for city traffic, and with those, all they do is they block the roads, and they stage maneuvers in the area so that the armed military men don't get involved with them, as not to accept any sort of provocation that can result in a physical confrontation between the two armies.
Give me some streets and try to paint a picture of just how they block.
I'll tell you where they block. They block the Amador Road, which is the one that takes you to the naval headquarters and also takes you to the SWAT, and where Major Cortizo now is in charge. And they also block the La Boca Road, that is the road that had the Balboa police station, so that they couldn't even communicate, because the Balboa police station is 2 miles from the Armed Forces headquarters.
When were these blockades removed, or were all of them ever removed?
No, they were removed when the Panamanian Armed Forces got notice of the coup, and after they did the first attempt to move the troops into the headquarters area. There, so they must have been removed, say, be about 8:30. Now, you also have to understand that the military Air Force of the United States also keeps, and kept today particularly, reconnaissance flights on top of Panama, keeping six helicopters at all times flying around the city and mainly in the headquarters area, plus two of the, I think the A-137 plane or something like that, which is a small jet plane, and then they had two C-130 flying over the city constantly. We don't know if they were carrying paratroopers or whatever they were carrying.
Now, on Friday, December 1st, I had a meeting scheduled with Captain Moises Cortizo. Captain Cortizo is the Panamanian military officer in charge of security for the entire Pacific side of Panama. And on this day, on the afternoon, into the evening of just this past Friday, on the way to meet the captain, word came in that there was an incident at the canal, that there was an armed standoff that United States troops had surrounded a Panamanian military police patrol. Captain Cortizo awaited my arrival, and then quite beyond any of my expectations for the interview that I had planned to do with him, he said, come on, and allowed me to accompany him as an observer. I rode with him in the van, or the Jeep, next to a machine gun armed Panamanian soldier, another man in the front seat. The captain was driving. I was permitted to record and to observe firsthand the following incident, which is what we might call a showdown at the Panama Canal. So just sit back now and let us experience this event.
Test, test.
Captain, can you tell me where we're heading now and what is happening?
Right now we're proceeding to Miraflores Bridge, where there's a small problem between a military police from Panama vehicle and some military police of the United States. According to them, they mentioned that they had some information that there was explosive in my military police vehicle, which is a lie. And they are trying to use force in order to inspect the vehicle. You will see, like in all the other cases, how they will use extreme force in order to accomplish things that are against the treaties. Because the vehicle they want to inspect is a official marked vehicle, which according to the treaty, they shouldn't inspect at all.
Presently 5:46 p.m. December 1st, 1989. And as you know, the canal has been closed for several days, and the Panama Canal Commission says it will be closed at least for another 2 weeks. That's what I was told at the entrance, because of a bomb scare at the canal. Do you, what is the relationship of today's development to that, do you think?
There's no relationship at all. Panama has never threatened the Panama Canal. Panama has never threatened a U.S. military or civilian citizen at all. Their threat comes from outside, not from Panama.
What will happen when we reach the place where you will deal with the Americans and your surrounded military police?
Like always, we're going to try to force the treaty to stand or to be respected. However, like usually they use force and they will disrespect the treaty as many times they want. And
we have just arrived at the entrance to the joint staging area of the Panama Canal. Here at the street, as the road enters, is a armored personnel carrier, number of troops, police cars, soldiers. On whose command? I just want to know for the record. Which army are you with?
Leave the reporter out there, sir.
On the way out, I confronted a spokesperson for the Southern Command in order to get the United States interpretation of this event.
Yes, Robert, like I was telling you, the...
Mercedes Morris, you're a public affairs officer with Southern Command. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What happened here?
Well, basically what I can tell you is that the security forces perceived a suspicious attitude in a military police vehicle belonging to the Panama Defense Forces. They requested to search the vehicle, and that was denied, and the situation has entailed until we were able to search the vehicle and prove or at least ascertain that there was no threat present in the vehicle.
What kind of threat might there have been regarding weapons or explosives or what? What exactly was...
I really couldn't speculate. Just types of threats. We are close to a very vital canal installation. We're close to the headquarters of the United States Army South. So we needed to take all the precautions necessary. We took them. We inspected the vehicle, and everybody's happy we're going home.
What were the suspicious activities that caused the vehicle to be stopped?
I couldn't speculate right now. That's up to the security forces and what they perceive at the time as being suspicious attitude.
What is the continuing status with the canal and access to it? I understand it was closed.
Access
or public access to the canal.
I'm sure you can go to the Panama Canal Commission, request access, or go to the Miraflores locks or whatever.
So you're satisfied with the events of today? Of
this? We're satisfied that we were able to have the security concerns prevail, and we were able to inspect the vehicle as we needed to do.
Thank you very much.
Crisis in Panama, an Undercurrents special investigation. Undercurrents has been examining the roots of the Panamanian crisis, while current attention is focused on the fate of Panama's General Manuel Antonio Noriega. Undercurrent senior producer Robert Knight was in Panama City shortly before President Bush's December invasion and continuing occupation of Panama, where Knight conducted an exclusive interview with Oriha Torrijos, sister of the late General Omar Torrijos. In this interview, Torrijos reviews the use of drug charges as an instrument of American foreign policy and discloses secret pressures by the United States government for Panama to intervene in the war in El Salvador.
Senator Robert Dole said that the military leader of Panama is involved in drug trafficking, his family is involved, and we should not turn over the canal to him. Most Americans think that he was referring to Manuel Noriega, but in fact, he said that in 1977. What do you think of that?
No. Primero, yo soy Aurea Torrijos, hermana de Omar Torrijos.
First of all, let me tell you that I am Aurea Torrijos, sister of General Torrijos.
Yo le quisiera recordar a todos.
I would like to remind all of you, when we were in the negotiations of the signing of the Torrijos-Carter Treaty, they also accused my brother of being a drug trafficker. And there was a struggle in a manner against him so that these treaties would not be signed. And imagine the image that they had created about my brother. And to imagine that I, his sister, was a student of drama. And this is where I was able to take note that what they were really after was the not signing of the treaty. But the treaty was signed. And now, since we are approaching the giving back of the canal in 1999. In 1985, General Noriega was then my brother's right-hand man, and Colonel Poindexter came, and at this time, he asked for General Noriega to invade El Salvador. At that meantime, they had said not one word against Noriega, because Noriega had contributed and collaborated in order to stop these drug traffickers. He had been the chief of security, and they had sent him letters of commendation for his deeds, the DEA did.
Y nosotros que habíamos ayudado al pueblo de Nicaragua, al pueblo sandinista, en contra de Somoza.
And we, who had helped the Nicaraguan people, the Sandinista government in Nicaragua, we were not going to allow for Panama to be a base in order to attack Nicaragua.
To attack El Salvador or Nicaragua?
No, El Salvador.
What was the purpose to attack El Salvador? Because the United States supported the government of El Salvador.
Porque la guerrilla El Salvador iba en aumento.
Because they wanted to attack El Salvador and Nicaragua and send Panamanian troops because they could speak the language and they could confuse them.
Oh, to support the government in El Salvador to attack the rebels?
Exactamente.
Exactly, to be able to combat against the Sandinistas and to be able to diminish the guerrilla movement in El Salvador. And at that time, General Noriega said no, that he would not allow this because he would not send Panamanian people to go and invade El Salvador and Nicaragua, our brothers. And then he told them that you would have to beware of the consequences. And take note of this, that right after that, 3 months later, they began to make these accusations against General Noriega.
Oriha Torrijos, sister of the late Omar Torrijos, interviewed by Robert Knight, who was in Panama 1 week before the United States invasion. This has been Undercurrents. This segment was produced by Robert Knight. For Undercurrents, I'm Jessica Gigi.
This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York, tracking all of the planets.
Would be a very fine place if and only if people read it. Let's send all the oppressors elsewhere, make the Earth a people's planet. The Earth would be a very fine place if and only if people read it. Let's send all the oppressors elsewhere, make the Earth a people's planet. Those
chauvinistic, sexist pigs who want all male domination. Don't believe in giving equal rights to half our planet's population. If they really think that the sexes have got so many obstacles between us, they can take their patriarchal order somewhere else, like Mars or Venus. The Earth would be a very kind place if and only if people read it. Let's send all the oppressors elsewhere, make the Earth a people's planet. Those imperialist dictators who think they're really great and grand insist that they and they themselves should have control over all the land. Those Stalins, those Ronald Reagans, I know of nothing stupider. Well, they'd have 20 times the land to rule if they just moved to Jupiter. The Earth would be a very fine place if and only if people ran it.
Katzberg and Snyder from Atomic Love, People's Planet. This is Earth, Earth Watch. My name's Robert Knight, and actually, it's a time that heralds some interesting transitions on the face of the planet Earth. There's been quite a bit of international xenophobia and absurdist kinds of reporting and political reactions in regard to the potential Asian crisis, in regard to Korea. And we have this dispatch just in from the Newswire. Reuters reports that the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has announced that it will indeed observe the global treaty banning the spread of nuclear weapons. Excuse me, this is the South Korean government saying that it, the South Korean foreign minister announced that the North Korean government will abide by the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That is essentially a confirmation of the discussions that have taken place between the United States and the DPRK, the government of so-called North Korea. And meanwhile, arrangements proceed apace for a summit meeting between the two Korean governments. And thus far, we are, I think, happy to report that even President Clinton has not fumbled this opportunity to change a needlessly belligerent history in regard to the divided peninsula. The breakthrough understanding that was achieved by former President Jimmy Carter does hold the water that was attempted to be rejected in early reports when he announced that the Premier Kim Il-sung of North Korea would suspend, halt, and continue to make inspectable the nuclear program there during the refueling of a nuclear facility, and that the United States now would engage in a more serious level of discussion and negotiation with North Korea. And it is about time. The nuclearization of Korea by the emplacement of United States nuclear weapons in that area, in South Korea, the charges that have been made of presumed weapons development, nuclear weapons development in the North, are they remain within the inspective domain of the International Atomic Energy Agency, an agency of the United Nations. What has happened in recent weeks is that the IAEA did indeed conduct a half dozen different inspections, and then based on claims made by the ever-reliable Central Intelligence Agency of the United States, additional increasingly intrusive demands for inspection were made, which the North Korean government claimed impinged upon its national security and matters of military security. Now, what has happened is that the North Korean government has said that the inspectors may remain, the fuel transfer is frozen, and in fact, I attended an event just last evening where the deputy ambassador of the DPRK to the United Nations stated explicitly that the North Korean government does not have intentions of developing nuclear weapons. The way that so many American, British, and other institutions have covered the affair would give the impression that with its long-range new missile delivery systems and its arsenal of nuclear weapons, that North Korea would be equipped and able, even right now, with those long-range missiles, to send nuclear weapons to Jupiter and bust up Comet Shoemaker-Levy and spare the planet Jupiter from a cometary impact, to judge by some of the paranoia and ignorance that we face on this side of the world. And during an event at which the ambassador spoke, I said a few words myself, and so did the former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, who gave an intriguing historical cavalcade of how, just by some coincidence, Douglas MacArthur, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and others assembled in Korea just moments before the southern part began artillerizing the northern part in the second phase, I guess you might say, of World War II. And one of the points that Ramsey Clark made is that after being occupied and enslaved by the Japanese occupation, after the various international issues that had confronted the country, no Korean soldiers ever fought on foreign soil, with one exception, when they fought in Vietnam, and that was at the behest of the United States, South Korean soldiers. There's a lot of history, I guess, that we generally don't know. And so because of that, you can find newspaper editorials saying, worth going to war. Well, it is not worth going to war. In fact, one of the items I brought to the table of discussion is that, of course, we're all concerned about nuclear weapons. And of course, these are serious issues, and they certainly deserve scrutiny. However, it has to be a fair and equitable scrutiny, and it has to be as well concerned about the proliferation of nuclear weapons through Israel and South Africa and Pakistan as it does the charges of that in North Korea. And if the issue is the production of plutonium, then why is it that virtually none, in fact, none in the establishmentarian press reports that I have seen, refer to the United States joint-operated fast breeder reactor that has been installed and is in operation just 30 miles out of Seoul, South Korea? That is a facility that's known by the acronym IPE, and it's operated by the U.S.-South Korea Joint Standing Committee on Nuclear and Other Energy Technology, acronymed JSCNOET. A fast breeder reactor has at its very basis of operation the creation of plutonium. This particular facility has already produced small amounts of plutonium. And in fact, the organization Greenpeace International obtained documents regarding the details of the operation of that nuclear site. And in an additional report, Greenpeace International pulled the cover on how this facility is negotiating with England, or with the United Kingdom, and with Russia for the reprocessing of the fuel with the intention of separating plutonium from it. And if one is concerned about a nuclear peninsula, we cannot have a blind spot in one eye just because United States troops prefer to be in South Korea, when in fact it may be the case that certainly judging by the increasing levels of protest against the militarization, that a considerable number of South Koreans as well as North Koreans simply want the military interference out so that their country can recombine, so that families separated for decades, it's almost a 50 years war, can have the ability to reunite. Those are some thoughts. The phone number is area code 212-279-3. You're on the air.
I used to be very politically engaged in to read a couple of newspapers every day and follow world events. And now something happened to me in the last 2 or 3 years. Seems that I get more and more disinterested. I have no more interest in what's going on in the world. All this bickering, political bickering, all this feud, and the world is fractioning, like, you know, pitting people against each other, all these factions of all sorts. And also it's about the onslaught of irrelevant information about it sometimes. It's like we're drowning in it. And talking about the astronomy issue, it seems to me now that the only books or articles, newspaper or magazines that I can finish reading are about the cosmos, about what's going on out there.
That's an interesting dilemma. I've thought about that.
Yeah, cosmology, astronomy, and I'm thinking also about the decline of the public interest in space exploration, you know, and I read a few months ago an article, I don't know which magazine, like some 50% of the American population didn't know that the Earth revolved around the sun, and actually
They must have been Catholic. Ask Galileo and the Pope.
Who don't know that the Earth revolves around the sun. You know, I'm a French teacher, and I have to talk to a lot of people, and I discovered that it was true. I mean, they have degrees, but the only answer that you can get from them is, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't get astronomy in college. I didn't get astronomy in college either. And my father, we didn't even have a degree. I mean, when I was 6 or 7 years old, explained to me what the solar system was. And it seems that I think we're missing something now. I mean, it's like the human mind, we're smothering upon itself, shrinking upon itself, and we're getting drowned in details. This onslaught of irrelevant information, feuds, you know, factions forming everywhere, and we're abandoning our curiosity, our drive to know what's out there, in there also. I mean, people wouldn't hear each other if they looked through a telescope.
Those are some interesting thoughts. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, yes.
May I respond?
Sure.
I've shared with you, I guess, the sadness about the lack of the eye into space that has happened over a decade or so. In fact, until the early 1980s, a tremendous amount of space reporting and research was done. The Voyager flybys of the planets completely changed our perception of the universe. We saw the hat, the brim, the rings of Saturn from the backside. That vision was as important to us, conceptually speaking, to understand the depth and the spatiality of our solar system as in 1969 when the first picture was presented of the Earth sitting seemingly alone in space with the photographs from the moon. At that period of time, from about 1980 onward, there was a precipitous drop in space research and in the reporting in journals like Science and Nature and so on. That seemed to exactly follow the way that these kinds of researches were defunded. They were defunded in two ways. Space was defunded. It was defunded through the what would become the Wall Street madness, people trying to make go-go stocks of biotechnology, and by governmental policy during the Reagan and Bush administrations. And these things are connected in that as we lost our view of our cosmic environment, what was happening on the surface of the planet was a period of ugly hostilities. The Contra War in Nicaragua, the invasion of Panama, the invasion of Grenada, the mad struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union, the Cold War, and so on. And I think that a view of the cosmos includes a look at the planet Earth, and that it's our responsibility to create the conditions on the surface that allow us to dream, that allow us to look into space. We cannot do that when people are having their throats slit in the night by United States trained soldiers, or when we may be annihilating someone in a third world country who may grow up to be a Nobel-winning space scientist. And as much as I enjoy free-falling through the spaces between the planets and seeing the metaphors of how galaxies include stars of high velocity and low velocity, and how the ones of higher velocity tend to gain kinetic energy from their encounters with the slower moving stars and get to move in bigger and bigger orbits around the galactic hub, meaning that in a way that's sort of like analogous to flight from the suburbs, when energy resources, or analogously financial resources, are taken from the poor in the inner city to aid those who can get rich and move out to the suburbs. I find that space is a useful social metaphor in addition to something to just be enjoyed for itself. So I agree with the pain, you know, that you feel about not having good educations and not really appreciating the wonder of space. But I think that what happens in space and what happens on Earth are related, that they're not just two separate things, and that we have a responsibility to live on Earth as well as in heaven. Don't you?
Yes, but we live too much. When I'm talking about the cosmos, the stars, I'm also talking about our inner selves.
Our inner selves and our social selves.
Yeah. I mean, it's there is so much inside ourselves. I mean, looking up to the stars is a metaphor. It is also looking down into ourselves, not just trying to blinding our mind, our possible curiosity, watching the soccer games. I mean, there's something else. It's like if we were trying to put a shield around to our perception of things, so not to see beyond, because we are afraid. I mean, there's a fear of seeing, of perceiving something beyond a very petty environment. You see, it's like when somebody was watching TV several hours a day, watching anything on TV, it's pitiful in that sense that that person is putting a lot of effort, building a wall, not to see into him or herself. Looking up at the stars is much looking into yourself, and so thought-provoking. It's the most wonderful show on Earth, and this is free. If you have access to a dark night sky, is lying down on the grass and look at the Milky Way. And you don't pay a cent for that, and that I would give anything to be able to do that tonight rather than going to see a Broadway show or a movie. I don't express myself as I would like to, but I hope you understand what I mean.
I understand exactly what you mean, and I think you've induced, I think, love for the cosmos and our surroundings and the development of the inner self as well with that. Thank you. Thank you for a thoughtful conversation.
Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Earthwatch. You too are on the air.
Everything is relative, depending on where you came from and what you're used to and what you'd like. A couple of things. You remember the movie Wrong is Right, Sean Connery?
Oh, an excellent film. It's almost like it's a prototype of what United States media and military policy does to foreign leaders.
Exactly. That's why I believe everything that's happened was completely orchestrated. And perhaps everyone was even in on it, just as a theatrical play to save face, to get this thing happen.
Yeah, tell the audience who didn't see that. It's an Albert Brooks and Sean Connery, isn't it?
Richard Brooks.
Richard Brooks, excuse me.
Last film. He died. He had written it. And he was a great film director.
Yes. Summarize it. Synopsize it.
Connery is a news reporter who goes on the scene where chaos is happening, and he's dealing with White House aides and Saudi Arabian people and giving gifts of cameras with poison needles. And Henry Silver is some kind of Mideast terrorist, and supposedly there's an atomic bomb that's going to be placed in New York City, and they find these bombs, and at the end, Henry Silver, what bombs? Everything was all staged, and everything has been revealed to Connery that he's been used, and it was all for the good.
The planes are on their way to Baghdad or to Pyongyang or wherever. And
it's a case of life copying art.
There's the dictator saying, what bomb?
And people, how people soon forget Blazing Saddles.
Mm-hmm. You know, I myself have come under the hairy eyeball for, you know, I traveled to North Korea. And I'm a careful reporter. And it is just as, these things are developing just as I expected.
It's all from a movie. I think that's the research they did to do. But the major thing I wanted to talk to you about, Robert, though,
yes,
was the healthcare special on NBC. I don't know if you caught that or heard about it, but it was incredibly propagandistically stupid, where guys from the Cato Institute, or better known as the Robert Barron Foundation, got up and said, well, this is nothing but socialized medicine. And at the end, they had a brain tumor. He said, what do you think? Well, I think we should all work together before she keels over. A few left. And then the most outrageous thing is that Brokaw said, oh, Mr. Senator Mitchell, what are you going to do? We had this survey, and 80% of the American public would not want to pay more money for 27 million people for their health care. And it didn't flinch a thing. I said, that's the most stupidest analogy. Anyway, the whole idea is for people to pay less money for health care and short the 27 million.
I have one observation about that. Do you know what a libertarian is?
I give up.
A conservative in denial.
I just can't believe how stupid the American people are and how stupid the network thinks they are. And maybe they are. And I just forget about it and never watch network TV again. It just drives me nuts, as I said to you last week. And it drives me nuts because I can't believe how many more people don't see it that way.
Well, maybe we're growing. Thanks for the call.
I know.
You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. I was kind of responding to the earlier call about how a greater consideration or knowledge of the universe can give us a different perspective that could be of value in terms of our own human relations. I've always been interested in astronomy, as a young boy and then later on and so forth. And I do think that the perspective of kind of realizing that where we are in a very vast universe is kind of helpful in terms of helping us to feel a little more humble, or as in that famous photograph of the Earth, how special the Earth is among everything that we've ever found. And it really is a great thing. And once you begin to understand the dimensionality of it and so forth, then, you know, traveling all over the world, you understand what's happening in terms of going north and south and, and all kinds of navigation, that kind of thing. It's a great thing. One interesting thing that was said to me, though, in my college years by a professor was, well, as interested as you are in this and as much as you know about it, do you realize that you will never be free of your original perception? When you wake up in the morning, you may say, oh, it was a beautiful sunrise. And you know it wasn't the sun rising. But you will never really say, oh, what a beautiful earth turn, for instance. That there is a part of us that is so rooted in kind of childish or, you know, kind of primary perceptions, that no matter how much we know, we do look out on a morning and say, oh, what a beautiful sunrise, or what gorgeous sunsets they have in the west. And he was right. I kind of just share that one thing, that no matter how much you know, it's very hard to get out of really impossible. He was right. It is impossible to really ever overcome, ultimately, this perception that you might just have as a child. Well, the sun comes up, and there it goes. And I don't know what the figure was given of how many Americans don't know that the Earth revolves around the sun. I think it's because even though at some point they did learn it, they don't experience it. And as much as I do know what happens, I experience sunrise, and there goes the sun across the sky. Finally it sets, or there the moon is coming up. We really can't get away from those perceptions. That's all I wanted to say.
You've got me
pardon?
Very much intrigued by the thoughtfulness of the audience on this occasion. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Maybe we are surrounded by dreamers. This is Earthwatch, and my name's Robert Knight. You're tuned to WBAI. There are lots of fine journals, you know, Sky and Telescope, Astronomy. There's a really excellent magazine called Earth, which induces some of the beauty of the idea of lying on the ground and realizing that you're experiencing, as the caller said, Earth spin rather than sunrise, sunset. The magazine is called Earth. It's an excellent one. And what we try to do here is stay technically adept, but then metaphorically meaningful, and to try to really bring the beauty of our surroundings into the immediacy of our lives. At least that's what I hope we're doing. Thanks for the call. All right. Oh, nice people tonight. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hello.
I have a poem that I'd like to read that fits the topic tonight, space and the universe. It's called What's Beyond the Milky Way. What's beyond the Milky Way? What's beyond this brand new day? What's beyond the sky so blue? What's beyond this day so new? What's beyond the universe? What's beyond this massive earth? What's beyond the moon and stars? What's beyond Jupiter and Mars? What's beyond the Milky Way, the Dipper that's far away? What's beyond the sky so blue? What's beyond this day so new? What's beyond the Milky Way, the morning star that greets the day? Tell me, is it far away? What's beyond the Milky Way? What's beyond the rising sun? He shines his light on everyone. What's beyond the sky so blue? What's beyond this day so new? What's beyond this galaxy? What's out there for us to see? What's beyond each starry night? What's beyond the moon so bright? What's beyond the Milky Way? What's beyond this brand new day? What's beyond the sky so blue? What's beyond this day so new? Have a great morning.
Thank you. That's beautiful. And obviously, the answer is revealed as we go farther along.
Program.
Thank you. This is Earthwatch. Sleep with no mercy.
listening to Earth Watch.
Hi, Robert.
Yeah.
How you doing?
Okay.
That's good. Oh, is this open discussion on, I guess, just events of space and what's happening? Maybe
yes.
I could discuss a few things.
Sure.
Have you ever read Eric Van Daniken, Chariots of the Gods and Gold of the Gods and these other books of ancient days when extraterrestrials visit the Earth?
I'm familiar with the books.
Yeah, those, you know, I've just got that video too, Chariots of the Gods. And, you know, I've been doing a lot of research, and I believe through my research and a lot of data I compiled is that these rulers of the Earth have come in contact with extraterrestrials, and they're trying to bring it out to the public. And in the future, like, they have shows on television now, like the X-Files and...
That, by the way, is an extraordinarily well-done program.
Isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I mean, people think it's science fiction, but it's real. I mean, actually, they're showing you... Science fiction is fact. I mean, they have time machines. They've... Area 51. I believe that they've even created robotoid replicas of leaders on this Earth.
Well, sure. Walt Disney World.
Right. I mean, it's so real. And
in fact, they're getting ready to make replicants of slavery.
Right.
And no doubt there will be thousands of people who will volunteer to play the part.
Amazing. And you know what I saw on MTV today, Robert? What they're doing, too, is a computer chip.
Mm-hmm. You know, the you mentioned Von Daniken, Chariots of the Gods and everything. I think that the utility of Von Daniken's books is shorter than the length of his books. I think that that perhaps the momentum of his enthusiasm with the idea exceeded what we might reasonably speculate about. I think that the useful part about Von Daniken is to accept the prospect that, as David Bowie said in The Man Who Fell to Earth, there have always been visitors.
Right.
However, discredit the actual accomplishments, intellectual and physical, of earlier cultures who we in our little tribal context don't think could have been that smart. In other words, we can't believe that ancient people in Egypt might have been smart enough to construct the pyramids by conventional engineering methods of which we are currently unpracticed in. We can't believe ancient people were so smart. And I bet you the ancient people could not believe we would become so dumb.
You're right. And they wrote about it in prophecy in the scripture, how dumb people would be dumb and confused.
Let me,
do you know anything about this other new author they have out now? His name is Sitchin.
Sitchin or Sitchin?
Return to the Stars. No, I'm sorry, not Return to the Stars. He wrote 5 books, The Fifth Planet. He talks about the creation. He has a lot of...
You don't mean the 12th planet, do you?
Right, yeah. The 12th planet and...
Yes, I'm currently attempting to review and see if it can usefully be brought into our discussions here. But as I move along, I'll leave you with a recommendation.
Okay.
All right, now that you've gotten through Von Daniken, I'd like to maybe recommend a more sensitive approach to the concept of interplanetary seeding. And that is a book by a remarkable woman named Doris Lessing.
Doris?
Lessing, L-E-S-S-I-N-G.
Okay. Uh-huh.
She wrote Golden Notebook, The Four Gated City, and many sociological insight books.
Uh-huh.
And then she turned to a form called space fiction. And the prime book of a meta book that she wrote, a series of books, is called Shikasta, S-H-I-K-A-S-T-A. And once you get that, you'll see the titles of the other books in the series. All of them are excellent.
Good.
It's probably in paperback everywhere.
Okay.
It was published some years ago, in the 80s, I think.
Okay.
And
It is a novel. It is fiction.
Okay.
And it doesn't even need to pretend to be real.
Uh-huh.
But what it does is arouse the issues and the humanity and it induces, I think, an understanding field.
Right.
So I hope you enjoy it.
Thanks, Robert.
All right. This is Earthwatch, 279-3400. You're on the air. A lot of calls.
Yes, right. You're great. You really like to hear from this poor, battered, excuse the word, individual. I know that word isn't used very much anymore. But in any way, it's really spooky. The television, you know, tells us how to perceive everything. And I don't agree with the caller that said, you know, that it's stupidity. I think that the media can make puppets out of us, you know, wind us up, wind me up. So in the morning, you know, I know who to hate, I know who to love.
So many of our opinions, both international and personal and social, are based on ignorance. And in the face of ignorance, ignorance opens up a floodgate through which our fears come rushing. And the system is overwhelmed. And people are often the victim of the ignorant fears of distant observers.
Yeah, I heard some elderly people talking in my building up the West Side. You know, if more people could smile like that nice man in ABC, Simpson, O.J. Simpson, you know, then things would be all right. Or like education, I was walking, you know, it doesn't make any difference how educated. I was walking towards Riverside Park, and this guy had a PhD in sociology, right by Tennyson. You know, there's a big black cloud overhead, and I said, well, unfortunately, it's going to rain. He said, no, NBC. He said, it's going to clear out. And he went out there. The confusion on his face, you know, when NBC let him down, you know. I was at a party once, and a man starts to go towards the wind, look at the great ships going up the Hudson. His wife says, what are you doing? He says, I want to look at the ships, sit down, she said. You see it better on television. So she got saved, went to Puerto Rico to go to the rainforest, which is an interesting area in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
People got off the bus and listened to this. They pulled up a contraption, and a beautiful blonde is doing the audio, and they're watching a video of the rainforest. Nobody goes into the rainforest. They watch the video, get back into the bus, and go back to the hotel.
Nature.
Massive.
Just like I pictured it.
No, massive. But I think there's hope. There's a group in Connecticut, just to finish up, housewives in Connecticut. It's a growing movement, apparently. I'm trying to find out more about it. Start something in New York. They don't buy any of the products they see on television. They make a phone call. You know, people hate to write letters. They make a phone call to the media, let them know what they're doing. They're not going to buy any of the products. And they're going to watch television one night a week. That's too much for some people. They get very anxious and depressed if they don't watch television two nights. Let's say they watch it 7 days a week. They watch it five. There's a lot of anxiety there, you know. So get people down, you know, they're watching it just two or three times a week. I think there's hope.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You've induced a sideways vision in me. You talk about watching the long ships sailing down. I look forward to the day that I can watch the big ships sailing along the ecliptic.
Oh, right. Thanks again.
Okay. This is Earthwatch. You are on the air.
Yes. How are you today?
Just fine.
You know it's going to be a full moon around 5:30 this morning.
Yeah, feeling it. Look at the brilliance that's being reflected among the people in these calls on this show. That's a sign of fullness.
It seems they all sound very similar.
Yeah.
Sense, you know? They got all the sense, like, most of them are like, they read the news. They're more experts with the news media. They get very hopeless when they find out, you know, people are being manipulated constantly. Like you mentioned Korea. What the hell are you picking on Korea for? You know?
There you go. And, in fact, well, sure, we kind of talked about that.
Space what and the Earth what are very similar, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes. You've gleaned the secret.
All right. First time I heard you, sounds pretty good.
Thanks for joining. My name's Robert Knight.
Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
Enjoy your life along the way.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for the help in doing that. You are on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, I'm really on the air.
Indeed, you are.
Well, this is
way from Boston, Robin.
Well, how are you doing, ma'am?
I think about you all the time.
yes, I remember you well.
I remember very well in 1950 when the Korean War's engagement started, you know? And now, I think this thing, I thought then that it was starting because there was a sort of depression coming on after the end of the Second World War. And I think this whole blow-up about Korea now has nothing to do with nuclear matters. It's just simply that the United States wants to have somewhere to use all their military stuff and get a big thing going like they did in Saudi Arabia and all. That's my opinion about that. Hello, you still there?
Yep. To a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
And then the other thing I had to say, I wanted to know if you've seen or heard of that book called Compromised written by, I think the guy's name is Terry.
It has been brought to my attention. I don't have a copy of it yet, but I'll report on it as soon as I do.
Well, took me back to the old Contragate days when I was there.
Yes.
I've got the book, but it's so big, I haven't had a chance to read all of anything except one or two pages.
Well, this is the second time in two nights it's been brought up to me. I understand that my colleague Bob Fass has talked about it a little bit here and there. I'll look into it, and we'll see what we do.
Well,
thank you, Lathrop.
Still love you here.
Love you, too. Love the sound of that voice.
Well, bye.
Bye. Bye, y'all. This is Earth Watch. You're on the air.
Good. Good evening. A gentleman asked earlier how to get people interested in science. And I can kind of express what interests me about nature and science. And it's just kind of understanding that there's a lot of things going on out there, and they're all related. Everything is related.
Yes.
Go into a stream. You turn over a rock. And there are these little pebbly-looking things on there. Those are little cocoons of bugs.
Yeah.
into damselflies flying around in the air in the spring. I mean, most people don't understand that there's anything even in the river. I mean, or you take your food scraps, you throw it in a pile, it turns back into dirt. Organisms make dirt out of food.
Yeah.
On and on, just all sorts of interesting things. They're related, like...
Here's a little piece of magic that I love. The barycenter of the solar system, the center of gravity, you might call it, is defined by the laws of conserving angular momentum. And what it means is that a little planet that's going around in the same direction, that's way far out from the center, has a bigger angular moment than sometimes even a much larger planet that's closer to the center. The result of all that is that every body of the solar system goes around the center of mass, or the barycenter, you would call it. And even the sun orbits the barycenter. The sun itself is not the center of the solar system. And the motion of the outermost slow-moving planets, the big guys, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, is such that they come into the same relationship, like, you know, the hands of a clock, the same angle, the same phase relationship, every 180 years, approximately. And it turns out that the way the solar system is churning and shaking up the sun like a great big soda bottle is that every 180 years there's a special way in which the sunspot cycle happens. And the changes in the sunspot cycle changes the electrical particles that the sun sends out, the solar wind, the magnetic field. And they, in turn, affect the magnetic field of a planet like this and others. And, in other words, life here on Earth is affected by the positions and motions of the planets. It's all, as you say, I say that just to reinforce what you're saying, that it's all connected.
Just a side note, that reminded me of astrology and, you know, birth signs and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I think that, you know, where the universe is when you're born and conceived, and even where you're standing now and how you feel is related to universe, but, you know, it's kind of not in the newspaper kind of quip way that they kind of write it up, though.
Very bright. In fact, some people think that
astrology, like the motions of the planet, the orbits of the planet, people are still in flatland. A lot of people think that it's a study of circles.
Yeah,
but the whole system is moving, and it's not circles, it's about a helix. It's about a great big spring-shaped mechanism. Because you're never at the place you were before, even though you may be at the same phase relationship of a circle. And so it's really a spiral, not a circle. And every moment is new. Thank you for calling. And I'm going to play this for you because you began the conversation talking about unexpected life in streams. And this is Van Morrison, and you're tuned to Earthwatch.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where I'm over the steel rims crack and the dead center back road stop, could you find me? Or would you kiss my eyes? Again. From the far side of the ocean, if I put the wheels in motion, yeah, I stand with my arms behind me, and yeah, I'm pushing out the door.
to be born again. To be born again. In another world, darling. Time. Got a home on high. Ain't nothing but a stranger in this world. I'm nothing but a stranger in this world. I got a home on high. In another land. So far away.
Van Morrison from Astral Weeks, the best album ever produced. One of the journals I receive is called Back to the Blanket, a basically Cherokee Native American journal, Back to the Blanket, and it features news of Native people and useful survival, market, and other kinds of tips. And a section called Gawonea, He or She is Speaking, Native American Poetry. One of the poems in the current issue is by Jerry Eaglefeather, a Mescalero Apache, who submits the following poem, not inappropriate to our discussions tonight, called Twilight in the Night. Consider whether this bridges the dilemma between our love of space and our concern for Earth and people on it. The poem, Twilight in the Night, reads, Twilight in the night, everything out of sight, the plains are clear, there is no fight. A long trek, we begin our plight, using our last might to survive this night. My people stay tight, run for your life. Praying, no attack this night. Crying, please God, not tonight. Our children just might live, so keep them in sight. Look, the mountain's height. There is shelter for the night. I think we can make it fly like an eagle with all of your might. Hard we run, the earth we bite. Thank you, Usin, we made it in the twilight of the night. By Jerry Eaglefeather. Consider how people on the peninsula might have felt with the needless escalation of tensions. That could be a native poem of Korea, as well as of the Mescalero, Apache, Cherokee. Anyway, that's African. That's from Back to the Blanket, a basically Cherokee Native American journal. If you'd like to receive it, you may contact them at Back to the Blanket, Box 527-524, Flushing, New York, 11352. Back to the Blanket, Box 527-524, Flushing, New York, 11352. This is Earth Watch. My name is Robert Knight, and you're on the air.
Hello, Robert. I just want to thank you for your program tonight. Initially, I was too tired to stay awake to hear you tonight, and I went to bed early. I turned in early, but I woke up to go to the bathroom around midnight, and I threw a tape in, and I expected just to try to force myself to stay awake and enough to flip the tape and maybe hear the program another day, but I'm glad I'm taping it because I know because of your program and how much I appreciate it, I'll throw the tape in the machine in the car maybe another week or two, and I'll be in a different place, and I'll just appreciate it even more.
How wonderful. I speak forward to that moment when you listen to that tape at a future time, and share the joy of your having consumed and cultivated the beauty of this moment that you're now enjoying at this moment in the relative future.
Thanks a lot.
All right. The Moody Blues, The Eyes of a Child. And that's about it for our vision on this edition of Earth Watch. I guess we'll see you next week. I've been Robert Knight. This is WBAI New York.
We invite you, the listener, to send your thoughts and comments about this series of commemorative programs and to share your memories of Robert Knight. A selection will be chosen and presented as part of future broadcasts. Send your emails to thenightreport@gmail.com. Knight is spelled K-N-I-G-H-T. thenightreport@gmail.com. Stay tuned for a live broadcast featuring some of Robert Knight's most illustrious guests. This program was produced by Robert Knight with assistance from Paulette Spencer and Catherine Davis.
The WBAI Community Advisory Board will be attending the hearing on September 4th, starting at 1 p.m. at the New York City Council Chambers at City Hall to endorse the People's Climate March on September 20th. Join us at 12 noon at City Hall in Manhattan to attend this hearing on global climate change at City Hall on September 4th, starting at 1 p.m. Join us for a 10-day...
And that broadcast was brought to you on recording, and this will not be a live program of Robert Knight. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly live radio program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Karen Hewler. Just trust me and stay tuned.
Hour of the Wolf movie review, air date September 4th, 2014.
Now, I thought I had
the
edited Congress, this part out. Oh, well.
Take one.
Take two. They're small.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. In the new film, The Congress, actress Robin Wright sniffs an ampule of clear liquid and turns into a cartoon. Not actually a cartoon, not even in the context of this film reality. It's an hallucination provided courtesy of her employer, actually her owner, more on that in a second, Miramount Pictures, which in this future world has gone from a purveyor of screen entertainment to faux realities that invade your brain. Robin Wright, the actress whose fame rests mostly on her role in The Princess Bride, plays Robin Wright, an actress whose fame rests mostly on her role in The Princess Bride, and who, in the Congress's opening act set 20 years earlier, allows Miramount to computer scan her physical form and capture her emotional states, to own Robin Wright, essentially, for whatever purpose they may wish. Hint, it's not for a big screen adaptation of The Cherry Orchard. Further hint, in case your intuition happens to leap there, it's not for a version of All-Star Celebrity Behind the Green Door either. Mainstream action film, babe. Statham, not Lovelace. Get your mind out of the gutter. In the main section of the film, Wright is guest at the Futurological Congress, a grand gathering where Miramount will unveil the next step in the evolution of psychotropic-based entertainment, hosted at a company hotel where it's mandatory that every guest don a cartoon guise. And it was with this cartoonish mise-en-scene that the Congress began to trip me up. I've been thinking about this film for over a week now. That I can't quite put it away says a lot to what's good in the film. For all the bitter irony in portraying an industry that has lost its grip on reality, both figuratively and literally, there is also a sadness to this story. The film Wright is given a son who is gradually losing his sight and hearing, involuntarily being forced to live a life within his brain that the rest of the Congress's characters are willingly surrendering themselves to. And in the film's most powerful sequence, which takes place during the live-action portion, Harvey Keitel, playing Wright's agent, provokes the actress through her emotional states during her scanning session, and the performances from Keitel as he tells her a reminiscence that runs from comic to tragic, and from Wright in her reactions, are fantastic. But then there's that cartoon, which largely takes up the last hour of the film. The Congress is based on Stanislaw Lem's The Futurological Congress, with that story's tyranny of pharmaceutical corporations replaced with the tyranny of entertainment conglomerates. Not an inapt modification. But instead of creating a clearly computer-generated virtual reality for the Congress's guests, which frankly is a tired trope at this point, director Ari Folman and his animation partner Yoni Goodman have created a hand-drawn environment that replicates the animation style of circa 1930s cartooning. I flashed on Bob Clampett's work in Looney Tunes during that period. Folman says it's more Fleischer Brothers. Same anarchic difference, I think. And as much as that decision breaks the scenario out of the expected cliché, it doesn't really speak to the Congress's themes. The current entertainment industry isn't really that nostalgic for the past, at least not for much that reaches further back than Terminator 2. And as much as Folman, Goodman, and a collective of animation studios work to replicate the rubbery dynamics of pre-war cartooning, a certain energy is missing, a situation that isn't helped by the cartoon version of Robin Wright, who functions, with the exception of one defiant speech, more as near-mute observer, acted upon and reacting, but doing little to drive the story. Since watching, I've struggled to figure out the relevance of using this brand of animation for this particular story. I keep trying to draw parallels between the delightful anarchy of Looney Tunes and the horrific anarchy that would result when individuals could populate whatever reality they choose and cast their entertainments as they see fit. But it's just as likely that Folman and company just wanted a reason to do some genuine classic animation, one shouldn't discount a cartoonist's innate desire to guide Mickey Mouse through a tap dance or engineer a shotgun exploding in Elmer Fudd's face. But in this case, the palette doesn't feel like it's serving the story. I'm probably going to come back to the Congress at some point. I'm unsatisfied, but also intrigued. A lot of the gambits seem not to work, but are connected to an emotional complexity that makes me want to explore deeper, see if I can find the connections. It may be a failed experiment, but it's also an audacious and exciting one, and that's not to be discounted. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are now archiving these reviews over at mightymoviepodcast.com. And if you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, be sure to check out Cinefantastique Online over at cfqonline.com.
Thank you, Dan. Now, I have not yet seen The Congress. I found where it exists online, and I have a free link to it, but as a reviewer, I should say. And I'm a big Stanislaw Lem fan. Solaris is one of my favorite novels, and I liked both movie versions of it. I know that's heresy. You're supposed to either like the Andrei Tarkovsky 4-hour Russian version, or you're supposed to love the Steven Soderbergh, George Clooney version of the same novel. Lem liked neither, but I liked both. I thought that Tarkovsky is one of the great science fiction movies up there with 2001. It's, in fact, an answer to 2001, but that's another show. Tarkovsky considered Kubrick the coldest movie director ever, and that's probably an accurate description. But that's one of the things people like about Kubrick. And Tarkovsky was one of the warmest, most humane science fiction movie makers out there. And people should check out The Sacrifice and Stalker and, of course, Solaris. He did Lem very, very, very well. And so here's this other film, and I'm totally intrigued. And I saw this animator's previous film, Waltzing with Bashir, which was an Academy Award. I'm not sure if it was nominee or winner. I think it won for Best Animated Film about walking along with an Israeli soldier along the Palestine perimeter. He does not shy away from hot topics, and he does not have easy answers, as one would expect from a person living in Israel. He's very conflicted about the conflict, and he's a very warm movie maker himself. So I'm very interested in seeing this film, but I'm going to do the awful thing, and I'm going to wait to reread the Futurologic